So I'm going to attempt to do two talks tonight and tomorrow night. That will be one big talk. I'm curious to see how this is going to go. In many ways, I've been writing this particular talk for maybe 10 years. The talk this evening is entitled The Wound That Seeks the Arrow. You've probably heard me speak of this concept before. I find it to be a fascinating concept. And so basically reflections on the many voices of suffering and reaction. So in many ways, a reflection this evening on the first two truths. But I'm going to attempt to really structure the flow of these talks in four particular ways. That is, I think, both challenging and also very important for the work that we're doing here. So I'm going to try to frame the talk in a tone and context of analogy, story, metaphor, imagery that might perhaps encapsulate the emotional undertone of the talk and the ideas that we're going to explore, and to some degree trying to speak from and to the emotional brain, the emotional side of things, which really is encapsulated quite nicely in this term, the wound that seeks the arrow, because that gives rise to lots of images, lots of metaphor, like what does that actually mean? I'm also going to try to follow the structure, logic and process of Dharma theory in a way that can emphasize the pragmatic nature of our work here. So really trying to talk about it in terms of structure and pragmatic, and that what we're doing here is actually quite doable. And in many ways that will be encapsulated in the teachings of the Four Noble Truths. But I actually don't think it's even the truth. I don't think it's even the tasks anymore. I think it's actually just the four. Because four is a very interesting number in many ways. It's a very important number in music theory. All the pop music that we listen to, 98% of it is four beats per measure, four time code. We have four noble truths, we have four foundations of mindfulness, we have four brahmaviharas, we have four great endeavors, we have four means of accomplishment, we have four elements, we have four directions, we have fours upon fours upon fours. And why is that, perhaps? Many people think, and I believe, that it's basically a mnemonic device for how to remember the Buddha's Dharma. And so, if you take lists of fours, and then you take the first term of each list, and you put them in another list, you get actually a whole other set of lists. So if you take the first foundation of mindfulness, and the first noble truth, and the first effort, and you turn the list the other way, you get this whole other set of four, which I'm not even going to begin to tackle this evening. We'll talk more about that on Sunday. But that would be understood as a great... If you didn't have written language, and you were trying to develop a device for memorization for a system as elaborate as the Dharma, then having these inverted lists would make lots of sense. In fact, the lists come much more to life, and they become a lot more instructional when we turn them the other way. So I'm going to try to stick with that a bit. Also, I'm going to try to provide personal and biographical experiences that hopefully will bring some of these ideas to life, to try to capture the humanness of the work that we're doing here, and trying to speak in a way that is both transparent and vulnerable. And in many ways, I feel a bit apprehensive right now, probably saying words I may have never said before. And lastly, for y'all is to really try to attempt to offer a contemplative framework that you can both apply towards and reflect upon your experience so far, and try to bring these concepts, ideas, and practices to life and really emphasize the relational and connectedness aspect of what we're doing here. So that might be a lot to think about, but that's how I'm trying to structure this in a way that will have a little bit of flow and interest. Because these Dharma talks are weird things to do, actually, I have to say. Of all the things I do, this is definitely the strangest. So what is a wound? Well, from the clinical side of it, emotional and psychological traumas or experiential wounds, which is what I would think about them, they're experiential wounds, are the result of unbearable, stressful events that leave us feeling unsafe and disconnected from everyone and everything around us. I don't know if you ever felt disconnected from everything and everyone around you. If not addressed in a meaningful way, in a transformative manner, they can go on for our entire lifetime, robbing us from our core potential for awakening and flourishing. Because of this, the wound is hurt and in pain. The wound is confused, unliberated, lost, scared, and angry. The wound doesn't know what time it is. It doesn't know how old you are, nor does it have any idea how much progress you have already made. The wound has been ignored and neglected. The wound has been told that it does not even exist. The wound does not trust you or anyone or anything. Because of this, the wound seeks the arrow. The wound seeks the arrow because it believes that destroying itself is the only chance it has for alleviation. The wound believes that the arrow will deliver it from its pain, anguish, confusion, and suffering. The endless searching and seeking for the arrow to relieve its burden only gives rise to the fires of greed, hatred, and confusion that stoke the flames of grasping, clinging, and fueling of a process that will never reach its intended goal. As they say, you can never get enough of something that almost works. The arrow almost works, so the wound continues to seek it. And this is what's known as the process of dukkha sankhara. So, as much as we can kind of get in these contexts, these four are very, very nuanced when we can kind of see them in this way. So we could say that the wound has a dukkha nature to it. And it has this relationship with Tana. It has this kind of wound-seeking arrow business going on. And so when we talk about maybe the ending of suffering, which we talk about a lot, the only thing that we can talk about really that we can intervene on and do something about is dukkha sankhara, which is the way that we construct a life and a reality and a person and experience around a kind of wound, which we've all... And usually by the time we meditate or by the time we even get into our teen years, we don't even realize that we've already constructed so many things. There's so much construction going on. That might actually be a better term for sankhara, is something Tan Jeff called the fabrication, but really construction. Gregory Kramer calls it construction. And we construct these experiences. So how can we understand woundedness in a way that is useful, that's helpful? One of the things that's been very helpful to me, there's an author, clinician, and spiritual healer named Mario Martinez, who has done lots of research, anthropological research around people in woundedness. And he has come to realize and teach, and there's actually a lot of people who are supporting his idea, that we get wounded, all human beings, no matter where you're from, get wounded in one of three ways, either through betrayal, through abandonment, or through shame. And this woundedness are archetypal. Now, archetypal is a form or a pattern. So things get formed and they get patterned. And their kind of hallmark is they're a constantly reoccurring symbol. So they're very symbolic. Right? And they constantly reoccur. And a lot of times they're so symbolic and they so constantly reoccur that we just think that they're features of experience itself. We think they're part of our life, they're part of the world. We don't realize that they've been kind of constructed in our mind. So I'll kind of go through them a little bit before I get into mine, which is the first one, which is betrayal. Betrayal is characterized as being very hot. So I'm always hot. I don't care where I am, I'm hot. I sleep with one leg out of the blanket. I'm always warm, I'm always hot, I'm always uncomfortable. I just run hot. My thermostat is set high. And I think largely that's probably physiological, and I think there's a betrayal aspect to that. There's an inflammation in my nervous system. It's still got lots of heat to it. And betrayal creates the field or the awareness or the kind of experience or maybe even the filter of frustration, powerlessness, and a kind of thwarted intention, which a thwarted intention is like, there's so many things that I can't do. There's things that happen in life. There's so many things that I can't do anything about it. And that makes me crazy. And so that's really kind of the way that betrayal wound can manifest. Its causes, some of its causes, are being lied to, being cheated on, when trust is broken, when agreements are not kept, being talked about maliciously, meanness or unkindness, abuse, and this is one of my favorite ones, when somebody does not take responsibility for their actions. We're talking about that last night, I believe. And so the antidote, how we work with this, is actually a worthiness, a sense that we try to develop a sense of worthiness, commitment and loyalty. And actually the most important thing around the betrayal wound is that you do not betray yourself, which is hard to do for some of us. Because that's the self-betrayal is the ultimate manifestation of the wound seeking the arrow. So there's that kind of experience. Abandonment is cold. It's very dorsal. Low energy. Feeling cold in the body. It creates the field of fear and terror at its worst. It can be caused by... Sorry, guys, we got cut off there. It can be caused by neglect, being ignored, being left, abandoned, both physically and emotionally, dismissed, parent-child role reversal, not being taken seriously, and having a lack of interest or support, and particularly from those people that we care about. Shame, also the antidote to abandonment is faith and confidence in oneself and one's practices or one's philosophy on life. Right? So having a sense of inner trust, inner confidence, a commitment to kind of ourselves and to our practices is the way out of that. Shame is also hot, very hot. And it creates the field of hopelessness and loss of meaning. Its causes are ridicule and criticism, blame and judgment, bullying, teasing, name-calling, guilt trips, and gaslighting. Interestingly, its antidote is integrity, sila. Its antidote is commitment to one's values. So these are really, I think, very interesting ways. And so the other thing to keep about these, is you all have all three, because I know you're sitting there diagnosing yourself right now. We all have all three, but one of them will notice there's a patterning or there's a reoccurring symbolic aspect to it. And even if some of our traumas or our life experience, I know wound's kind of a big word, you know. Not everybody, but we all have them. There are various forms. They can be very, very strong and very, very obvious. They can be very, very high on the ACE score. But they can also be kind of subtle. And it can also be not so obvious. Most people, actually, it turns out, most people diagnose themselves incorrectly. So whatever you're thinking yours is right now, you're actually statistically probably wrong. Except for me, I nailed mine right out of the gate. So I want to talk a little bit about how this has impacted me and why I think this is so valuable. And so we think about these wound installations and when they manifest. And so I think until I was about 11, I think I had a great life. I think my parents did a more than a good enough job. I think I was felt supported by the world. I think I felt like the world was going to provide me the things that I wanted to. I felt positive. I felt good. I was in fifth grade. 1986 is the year I want to talk about. There was a week that happened in 1986 that really I've explored in trauma therapy and in parts work and really in my own practice around really trying to kind of get down into my somatic experience of this kind of stuff and really trying to uncover this dukkha and the dukkha sankhara and what has arisen out of it. On Friday, January 24th of 1986, my older sister was in a car accident on the way to school. She wasn't allowed to drive with her friends. My parents would not allow her to do so, but the walk to the bus stop was quite long, and somebody, one fellow and another girl had picked her up, and they actually were trying to pass the school bus that they were supposed to be on when another car came the other way and they turned off and hit a telephone pole. And the two people in the car died immediately. And my sister was flown to Haverhill, Massachusetts, to the medical facility. Of course, I didn't hear about this till about 3 years ago.
Right.
So that was the Friday, January 24th. January 26th, my favorite team, the New England Patriots, were at the Super Bowl. And they got clobbered. You might have known this if you live in New England. They got clobbered by the Chicago Bears, 46-10. I still remember the score. And it was the beginning of realizing, I knew my sister was in the hospital. I knew that things were probably much worse than was being let on. And everybody was like eating potato chips and watching the football game and drinking beer and doing all the stuff that you do when you watch football games. And I completely started to get this osmosis feeling of like something coming on, like there's something going on here that nobody else is seeing that I think is terrible and bad and I'm not sure what it is. It was that first feeling I had. And you, some of you know this feeling, the other shoe is about to fucking drop. Then I know it, and nobody else seems to know it, and nobody else seems to care. So I went to school. That Tuesday, January 28th, I grew up in New Hampshire, Southern New Hampshire. Some of you might remember this. There was a space shuttle, Christa McAuliffe. We were all rushed to the auditorium in school to watch Christa McAuliffe in the town, one town over from where I lived, who was going to be the first teacher put in outer space. Right? She was a school teacher, Concord, New Hampshire. I was a town over Derry, New Hampshire. We all went to the auditorium in school to watch it. It's so funny because the TV was like this big. We couldn't even see it. They wheeled out like three of them on. Remember they used to wheel the carts into the classroom? And you probably know what happened. The space shuttle blew up. And I was like, I fucking told you, man. The other shoe's about to drop. And then Friday, January 31st, my sister died in the hospital. And everybody came. Of course, I wasn't told this, but everybody was at my parents' house, and everybody was crying and hugging and all that, you know. And they might as well have just spray painted on the wall. It was very obvious what had happened. But nobody told me. Until Monday morning, when it was time to go to school, my parents told me that I wasn't going to have to go to school and that my sister had died and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And so there was like, it was like a whole 7 days of like, I could feel it. I could taste it. I could smell it. It's like electrical kind of taste. It was like tinfoil taste in my mouth the whole week. Right? And so that was like really this massive, what they would call catastrophic loss. I felt sad, of course, but I really actually, truly, honestly felt betrayed. I felt really betrayed by my parents because I wasn't giving any, information, and I've long since forgiven them, and I can understand why parents losing a child might not want to talk about it to their 11-year-old son. Like, I can kind of see how that would work. Nonetheless, it did not do me any good. And so I had this first Dharma experience, really, of impermanence. Here today, gone tomorrow. And then a couple days later, I'm back in fifth grade math class, and everybody again is acting like everything is fucking normal. I don't talk to the guidance. Nobody even acknowledges that this has happened. You know, of course, I'm sure my 11-year-old friends didn't really know, didn't really have the skills or the wherewithal how to handle that, nor did the teachers. Right. So I kind of got dropped into this reality of like the world is, the world is unsafe. I can't trust anybody or anything. Unbearably stressful and feeling unsafe and disconnected from everyone and everything. You know, terrible. But then, strangely enough, that went into latency. And so I think also with that, there was also a Nibbanic element to that, because sometimes these things happen, and then I kind of was really actually kind of okay for a couple of years. I think I had the social support from people at school. I had known that it had happened, and I kind of glued myself back together. And they say this, Ajahn Buddhadasa says this about this Nibbana. He says, any reactive emotion which is fueled by a traumatic wound that arises will cease when its causes and conditions have passed away. Without its ceasing, no life could ever endure its painfulness. So if we were in this reactivity, in this tanha, in this wound-seeking experience 24/7, we actually wouldn't even be able to handle it. Right? So this Nibbana experience, as much as we talk about cultivating it or developing it, it's actually not much different than dukkha. There's dukkha and Nibbana, and sometimes things just cool off. No life could endure it. We are only able to survive because Nibbana nurtures us, and it nurtures us until it becomes a natural habit of mind. And so we get glimpses of these kind of these aspects of the four truths, as they're called. We get these glimpses into the horrific, terrible nature of dukkha, but we do get these kind of reprieves sometimes. We get these reprieves, and I had it for a couple of years. So then the question becomes, well then, what is the arrow? What is the metaphor of the arrow? The canon described it as this. The arrow is craving or reactivity. And it says this is it's arising. So he talks about the craving or the tanha that we talk so much about doesn't actually cause the dukkha by any stretch. It arises out of it. So it's dependent. The arrow needs the wound. Right? It needs the wound to do what it needs to. It arises out of that. And the Buddha says this. This is the arising. It is craving, which is repetitive. Wallowing in attachment and greed, obsessively indulging in this and that. Fixing and controlling, avoiding and ignoring, craving for stimulation, craving for existence, craving for non-existence. And that's that beginning that we start to get when we start to get these glimpses into the, as Bhikkhu Bodhi called it, the gaping, groundless ground underfoot that we know the bottom can fall out at any time. Some of us have seen the bottom fall out. And when you see the bottom fall out, and you've seen the other shoe drop, it's hard to forget that that's possible. So we start to construct a reality, or we start to live in an experience that things could somehow be other way if only. You know, we start to really get this kind of arrow wound-seeking experience with some of the things that we've been through, some of the things that we've happened that we just don't understand. Because again, the definition of the wound, it's angry, it's scared, it doesn't know what's going on, doesn't know what time it is, it doesn't trust anybody, it doesn't trust anything. All it knows is that really needed to not happen. Right? It doesn't know how to do anything but that, so it just keeps doing that. And so we also talk about, there's this other metaphor that I think is really important, is that of fire. And the analogy of the clinging is more of an arrow that seeks a wound. The craving is more of an arrow that seeks the wound, rather. And this clinging that we talk about, grasping, is more actually related to a fire. And so it says here, this endless searching and seeking for the arrow to relieve its burden only gives rise to the fires of greed, hatred, and confusion that stoke the flame of grasping, clinging, and fueling in a process that will never reach its intended goal. And one of my favorite things to do, and I'm sure most of you like to doing it, it's very enjoyable, is to watch a fire burn. And what does it do? What is the fire? And that's why the Buddha uses the analogy often of fire as clinging and grasping, and Nibbana as cooling. Those are very easy metaphors to understand, right? Like there's heat and there's fire and there's cooling. And if you watch a fire, it both grasps and clings at the log and also fuels it at the same time. This word upadana has a double meaning. It means not just to cling in the grasp, that's usually how we think about it, right? But it also means to fuel. So it's like running on its own power. It's clinging and grasping and fueling the clinging and grasping at the same time. Right? Much of the time going unnoticed. We don't see that that's what's happening. We don't recognize that. So then at the wound kind of reopened or re-triggered when the causes and conditions were appropriate. And for me, that was going to high school. So I graduated from elementary, not from junior high, and I had to go to the high school that my sister went to, which I think was the big trigger. And I actually had to ride the bus down the same road past the same telephone pole that she hit every single day on the bus. And of course, there was like a little thing there, a little memorial thing. So every morning, it was just a reminder of that experience. And they talk about emotions in teenagers as researchers have found that adolescents tended to experience many emotions simultaneously, but they differentiate them poorly. In other words, a teenager might constantly and consistently feel angry and sad at the same time, but it indicates that it's difficult and sometimes impossible for them to distinguish the difference between the two. And I don't know what it was like when you were 14, 15, 16, but all of a sudden, like, I just got this, like I went from dial-up emotional to, like, full-on 5G Wi-Fi emotion. You just, like, just boom. We're just on. And so all of this kind of early woundedness, all of this stuff, it just kind of came right back online when I was in high school. And that was really where the dukkha really started to not so much have the craving and the clinging, but I think what it does, it kind of creates this filter or this kind of dark cloud in our mind and our heart where we kind of get this existential dread and we get this really strong feeling that the world is unsafe. That thankfully, I was not suicidal, but I really didn't want to be here. I really did not want to be here at all. And I remember walking down, and I went to a school, high school in southern New Hampshire that had, we had like Pinkerton Academy it was called. There was like 5,000 kids in the school. Like my freshman class was 1,000. We were the first class that hit 1,000. So there was 1,000 freshmen. So trying to make connections was more or less impossible. All this feeling of like, am I the only person who feels this way? and just looking at faces every day down the hall. Nope, 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 nope. Every, you know, like I'm, and it was this weird dichotomy of like, I almost felt special or unique, or I almost felt there was something actually ironically beautiful about the fact that I sort of knew something that nobody else knew. And at the same time, I felt tortured by it. You know, and thank God for punk rock and hardcore and heavy metal music. I used to save my lunch money. Instead of buying lunch, my mom would give me $5 for lunch, and I would always buy a joint from somebody at school. And I'd get home before my parents would get home, and I'd smoke the joint. And I would go in my room, and I would like put the speakers on the left, like they were headphones. And I'd put like 5 like Coleman L.L. Bean sleeping bags on top of it. And I would just lay there and listen to like Megadeth and Metallica. And like I would go to Strawberry's Records and Tapes, and I would try to find, I would buy the tape that had the most aggressively violent cover. Like I remember when Kill 'Em All came out with like a sledgehammer and blood. I was like, this is totally going to be awesome. And I would go, and I would actually take refuge in that. And one of the first things that I started to recognize that was refuge for me, the other thing that my parents did that was very destructive, actually, and I totally forgive them for it, and I'm told by people in the clinical world, they didn't touch my sister's room for like 2 or almost 3 years. Mm-hmm. Like we just, it was like this room in the house that like nobody went in, but it was all her stuff was still in there, like the same day that she left for school. And I'm told that this is very unhealthy to do this. But I used to go in there because my sister had a shoe box of tapes under her bed, and she had a little boom box in those big 70s, which I still use those. I like the big ones. I don't like the earbuds. I like the bigger the better. Like I want them to weigh like 15 pounds on my head. And I would go into her room, and I would put the headphones on really loud, and I would listen to Black Sabbath and Aerosmith, and it felt so wrong to be in there, and it felt like I was going to get in so much trouble, but I felt connected to my sister, and I would go in there, and it was like a kind of a Dharma thing. It was like I really took refuge in it. I actually felt safe. I felt connected. I liked the music, and every once in a while, I'd get caught, and my parents would get really mad. They were really mad. Which only made me want to go in there more. And so this went on, luckily, for just really a couple of years. But it was, that's why I think I worked with teenagers, and you know, I worked with teenagers for a long time, and working with teenagers in juvenile detention and substance abuse, I think actually for much of my life really healed a lot of that inner teenager for me. And so that was one thing that I did when I lived in Nashville, Tennessee, that really, really kind of took care of a lot of stuff. It was really meaningful to me to sit with young people and just hear their stories. You know, and that was all I wanted to do. I was just like, I just want to hear your story. Like the worse it is, the more I want to hear it. You know, because I got one too, man, and it's probably just as bad, if not worse, or equally horrible. And so then I got really lucky. Really lucky. My parents lost their business. My dad's got a construction business in the late 80s. The economy went terrible. My dad lost his construction business. We lost our house. We had to give our cars back to the bank. We totally had that whole thing where the bank just comes and like you have to, they just basically clean you out. And we had to move in with my grandparents who lived 2 hours away in Western Massachusetts in Northampton. So me and my dad moved in with his mom. And my mom and little sisters moved in with her mom. And that was the best thing that actually could have happened to me. Because I was doing lots of drugs in New Hampshire. I was breaking into houses, stealing things, selling things. I was really, really criminally headed, for sure. And then I got really lucky. I moved down the street from Daniel Goleman. And I met his children, so I became friends with his kids. And this is really where the Dharma started to kind of, I was only maybe 16 or maybe 17 at the time, but I remember hanging out at Danny's house, and we taking acid and smoking weed and doing all the fun stuff that you do when you're a teenager. And he had, his dad, of course, in his garage had like bookshelves upon bookshelves. And he had all these books on Buddhism and Dharma. And I would look at him and read at him, and I never had a friend whose dad was like that. It was very interesting to have that. So I really actually, by the time I was 17, 18, I graduated from high school, I started working for Greenpeace, I had this actually really, really wonderful experience of like, I think I'm going to be okay. I think I'm going to be okay. I'm really coming out of the woods here. You know, I was really into the environment. I worked for Greenpeace back when we were going to, remember we were going to save the rainforest in the 90s? I don't think it happened. I like to tell people that I did try. And so I would get these reoccurring patterns. I would get these kind of falling, as kind of rocking back and forth between these intense feelings of betrayal and woundedness and the world is unsafe and why is it like this? But then also these kind of what I would call a nibbonic latency where it would cool off. It would cool off and I would kind of be okay for a while. Right? And things would seem like they were going to be okay. But I always had this and I don't have it so much anymore and I'm really glad to see it go. Is this feeling of the other shoe's going to drop at any time. Right? Which actually, so in the inability, so there's an emotional inability that kind of happens here, and what it is, it's on one level, it's an inability or an unwillingness to be sad. Because when you have capital T sadness, catastrophic loss, sadness just becomes really scary. Right? And so there's a way which we kind of, we start to develop a kind of armoring or a protection of like, okay, like, and then I reading Buddhist texts and I'm hearing things like this path of mindfulness is about overcoming and ending lamentation, grief, and despair. This is the path that leads to the end of, I read that as this is the path that leads to the end of sadness is the way I read that. Lamentation, grief, despair, that all sounds like sadness to me. Right? And so then I started to develop this kind of destructive sadness. Right? Where I just, that became kind of where the wound became, I think started to become ignored and neglected. I was like, yeah, I'm all better now. Right? We kind of can go into these things. And I'm actually glad that we go into these things because, you know, it can be really helpful to go into these latencies where the big events kind of cool off a little bit and we can readjust and we can navigate the world in a way that's a little bit more easy. So we find, I started to find like through all this, there was like, that almost like I feel like these four domains of like, there's kind of the domain of life that's dukkha, there's like the minor key of life, I think about it. There's like this dark sadness, loss, that's built in. And sometimes we're there, sometimes that's where I'm at. And if I can't navigate that with some degree of skill, then what happens is I end up in this other domain of my experience, which is the domain of reactivity, of heat, of flare-up, of clinging, of arrow-seeking. Right. So that's part of our experience too. So they're almost like this, and we kind of move through them. And then we have this other experience of coolness, of nibbana, of I think I'm going to be okay. Like it's, you know, it's not necessarily profound. It's certainly not enlightenment or any of these big words. It's just a kind of, and then we get in this experience of path, of living, of flourishing, of doing the things that we want to do. And I feel like we kind of move through these four all the time. But the question becomes, we oftentimes, I know that sometimes I get the wires crossed. I get them confused with each other. Right? And so when we don't have a capacity for sadness, we also don't have a capacity for joy. And so I got into this really playing and saving. I'm like, well, And that felt like a fair deal for me. I'm like, well, you know, you can keep your, if you keep the sadness away, you can have the joy too, actually. If that's the deal that's being made here, I can live with that. Because the sadness and the loss in that dimension of dukkha is so intense and so painful that if I have to sacrifice joy or love or connection, then I'll take that deal, actually. And so we get into this kind of like, we paint ourselves into a comfort zone that's actually not very comfortable. And then just when I thought everything was going to be fine, I was just got out of high school. I had my own apartment. I was living in Northampton, Massachusetts. I'd met a girl, and we had a very short relationship. It was, as they say, big fire burns fast. It was one of those, you know, when you're 19 and you fall in love and you're like, oh my God, you know that thing? You guys had that thing? It's kind of delusional and painful, but it's also quite delicious and awesome. That was it. And we were, it was a night, it was, where are we now? It's like actually right around this time of year. It was September. What is it now, October, September? I don't even know what fucking day it is. We were walking in Northampton, Massachusetts in the fall. And we had just gotten in a big fight, and we had just kind of cleaned up, and we just kind of like got it together, and it was like really feeling good. And we were walking through this field, and there was this person who was driving drunk and would drive into the corn and run the corn over and drive back on the road. So we got off the road where the drunk driver was going, and he just happened to turn into the corn where we were standing and hit me, and I flipped over the car. She was much shorter. Hit her and ran her over and dragged her body about 500 feet down the dirt road. And then I kind of came to, and I don't even know how long it was. Maybe it was 30 seconds, maybe it was 5 minutes, and I ran down the road and found her and rolled her body over, and her face was gory and her eyes were kind of not in their place, and there was like blood and very heavy breathing and all that kind of stuff. And that was the ultimate betrayal, the ultimate. I remember that experience intensely, and I just remember, like, I still feel like I have electricity in my nervous system right now from that. It was just like huge. And then I went and found the police and this whole big story and this whole big mess. And then it was at that point I was really I was betrayed again by the universe. It was like, so again, it was this reoccurring symbol. Here, you know, it was another one. It was like, you know, and I'm like 19. I'm like, I got like three of these under my belt now. Right? And so that really kind of dukkha installation. So it kind of kept reoccurring. And then the story I would develop about the world being unsafe and can't trust anybody or anything would just get more extended and more elaborate and more intense and more self-referential. And that was when the point when sometimes these betrayal wounds start to team up on you, then that was when I started to actually feel shame about the terrible things that had happened to me. And I think that that's where, and I haven't really uncovered this yet. I don't actually generally feel like when they talk about unworthiness and the betrayal wound, I never read, I'm like, I don't really feel unworthy. But I can only imagine there has to be somewhere down in there that's actually probably there. Like, I don't feel like I've gotten there yet. I'm not really looking forward to getting there. But I feel like there's this thing that's still happening there. And then, of course, immediately after that, you know, about 2 months later, I developed a really close relationship with Hanuman, who was Danny Goleman's second son, and a really close relationship with his mom, Anasuya, who was Danny Goleman's first wife, who had sat in a lot of Goenka retreats in the 70s with everybody that we know, Jack and Joseph and Ram Dass. She was all in that crew. She was with Neem Karoli Baba, and she was with she sat a lot of retreats with Goenka. She was just like, at that point in my life, she was like the most, and she, I'm still close with her today. She is the most marvelous lady on the planet. Like, hands down. I wanted her to be my mom. I wanted her to be my sister. She was just like, you know, she still is like that. She just has that quality. And not to digress, but there's actually a whole bunch of women like that out there who became moms, and they developed this Dharma lifestyle, but they're not on Dharma Seed. They didn't write books. There's all these Dharma women in our culture who are amazing that nobody knows about. They're like hanging out in some kitchen in New England, totally living the whole life path, right? And so she's that person. And she had said to me, she said, well, I think maybe you should go talk. I remember talking to her on the phone not soon after the accident. And I don't really remember it happened actually ironically on September 11th, 1993. And somewhere around 2 months later, around my birthday, which is November 18th, I talked to her. And she said, well, I don't know what we talked about. I just know we talked on the phone for like 5 hours. And she really talked me off the ledge. If I ever had, if I ever would wish to have a recording of a conversation, I would sell my soul to the devil to get a recording of that conversation. And she said, maybe you should go to, I have a friend who's at IMS right now named Stephen Smith, maybe you should go. Talk to him. But yeah, you're like, talking to your friend's gonna help me. And then the best thing was the ride up there with me and Hanuman. We were driving up to, the 3-month retreat at IMS had just ended. So there was a party at Joseph Goldstein's house, and Joseph was there, and Sharon was there, and Stephen Smith was there, and Stephen Armstrong was there, and all these teachers that I know and love that I first met were all there. And we had gone to UMass to pick up Stephen Smith's daughter, Chandra, who's a friend of mine. And then from UMass to Barry to IMS is about an hour drive. We must have smoked like so much weed, like so much weed. And we walk into Joseph Goldstein's house just like completely high as can be, right? And all these people are here. And that was really, I can actually remember that room. I can actually remember the smell in that room. It's almost like the opposite side of, they say in trauma, you capture these really big memories, but also in meaningful experiences, you actually capture the same kind of thing. You remember smells and you remember things very vividly. And then we spent the night, actually the IMS had just purchased the Barry Center for the Buddhist Studies, which is like right through the woods from Joseph's house. And I remember walking in the snow with a flashlight high as a kite, like through the trail through IMS, which I've walked on a million times since then, to the farmhouse at BCBS. And we went up the back stairs and slept, and Stephen Smith came over like at 6 a.m. the next day. Right. And some of you have probably heard this before, but that was really the massive shift. You know, we talk about Dharma transmission sometimes that we get. And it was really the first of all, it was the first time in my life ever that I felt like an adult wanted to hear what I had to say. Right? Which is very odd. You know, and it's kind of sad to think I made it that far and no adult ever sat down and said, what happened, man? You know? And I don't know what we talked about. Again, another conversation I would love to have a recording of. But the thing that really, really blew me away was the normalizing of, like, you know, based on what I had told him and how I felt and what I was experiencing, what he reflected back to me was like, well, how could it be any other way? Of course that's, you know. And he framed it, and I've been chasing this kind of idea for 30 years, he framed it in a way that, like, it sounded in many ways what he was saying, that this was going to be the best thing that ever happened to me. That these experiences were going to put me on a trajectory and onto a path and onto a way of life that most people will never stumble on. And so I used to call it sometimes the wisdom of dissatisfaction. And that actually, the wound or these experiences, they also contain with them all of the Dharma. All of the teachings are said to be, just as the footprint, the elephant's footprint in the forest, all the other animals' footprints will fit inside that footprint. It's also said that all of the Buddha's teachings sit and fit inside the Four Noble Truths. And so it was this, my mind was literally blown. And then he asked me, he said, well, do you want to try some meditation? Is this meditation helpful with all this stuff? And so I went and met him at the hall at Insight Meditation Society the day after the 3-month retreat. I remember just sitting in the hall with just me and him, and he just gave me kind of mindfulness instructions, you know, like, go back to your breath, the mind wanders, you come back, you know the drill, right? Boom! Completely exploded. Like, I really, really saw that everything that I was, this is what I was talking about the other day, that I really was actually had the insight into seeing that suffering was actually just a phenomenological experience that was happening in my mind and body in the present moment, and none of it was real. Doesn't mean none of it didn't happen. Doesn't mean it wasn't sad, but it wasn't a dismissal or a refusal of any of that stuff. It was just this is how it is here. This is what it means to be human. And you are seeing what it means to be human in such a poignant way in sealing the saliency of this experience. And then seeing at the same time or in the next moment that you can be fully liberated or fully beyond that, so that just like, it's almost like the Four Noble Truths are like, in every single moment, there's dukkha and then there's reactivity, but if there's not reactivity, there's nibbana. And you're like, wow, that's pretty cool. But then of course, 2 seconds later, the reactivity comes back up again. So these four, so I think the only way to think about them as there's these four. And they're a meditation practice. And haven't you seen it today? Haven't you seen this? Like, there's the pain in the body. And it's not like it's like this big, heavy woundedness that we're feeling. But there's this pain. There's this kind of, I don't really want to be here. I don't really want to do this. I don't really want to feel this. I don't really like this. And then we immediately construct a way in which it could be different. And then how much better it would be if it wasn't like this. And so we see that there's a pragmatic nature to the practice that's so fascinating. And then that we see that these, the joy and the sorrow and all these kind of ideas that are polarized are really not different at all. You know, you can't have the nibbana without the dukkha. So when you think about these kind of as frames of experiences, that we see that there is this potential, there is this vulnerability, there is this not knowing, there is this, there's all these things that we can't control, we're powerless, we don't know what's going to happen. It's all really very real. Right? So we can, and also when we say embrace, that it also implies and certainly means that there's compassion there. And compassion is a very tricky word because we don't necessarily realize that the term for compassion is this term anukampa, which is, it's not karuna. Anukampa is the term that they often say, the crying out of another. And so for me, that's what it was with these deaths. It was crying out at the crying out of another, except for me, there was no other. There was just me. And it was just an isolated person having this experience. And that we, when the Buddha talks about consciousness and talks about the experience and the mind and the body, how it arises, what comes up in that is that friction, that kind of difficulty, that kind of, the way they talk about dukkha, it's like an ox cart that the wheel doesn't fit right. You ever have that feeling? I always have that feeling. Something just not quite right about this whole thing. Yeah, that's right. That's actually true. Maybe they are true. Right? So the only thing that we could do, the only thing that would make sense is compassion or kindness and a recognition of the shared humanity. That's what I was missing all those years, I think, as I did. I had no sense of compassion. I had no sense of there was anybody else crying out. And that's why practicing with other people and being in community and meeting other people on into the Dharma and on this path, it's so great because it's like, there's nothing that's more relieving when you have horror stories and you hear other horror stories. It's like I'm not happy for you, but I see you, I get it. And so anukampa and dukkha are kind of like it's all right in there. Right? So the only thing that makes sense is kindness. The only thing that makes sense is care. Now if I can't bring that to myself for myself, then I have work to do, much work to do. So that's why we emphasize that so much in the practice. Right? Is that, can I be kind? And so I'll talk more about this tomorrow, but this is really where it goes into, I can say that the wound is healing, the arrow seeking is lessening, and the burning is cooling. Right? I have nothing but stories upon stories of evidence that I can tell you about how that's the case. Right? But it's not like I can't have one without the other. Right? And so we can really try to integrate or to try to collect or try to wholly arrive in the experience that we're having. How could it be any other way? This is how it is. And it's not great news, it's not terrible news, it's just how it is. And there's so much that we can do. And so I'll talk about this more on the Nibbana side of it tomorrow, about how these experiences, it's not a linear, it's not like you go through these, it's like they kind of are always coming and going all the time, and we can continue to lean and we can cultivate our mind towards this other way. And then the things that have happened or the things that we've been through are just, they're just that. Right? Lastly, I'll say, one of the things that I learned in actually doing trauma work, one thing I realized it was just like Four Noble Truths on steroids, the whole thing. And it was like we did all these timelines. That's why I know these dates so well, because I have all this, all these files and all this work. I did 112 hours of work on a lot of this stuff, so I know times and dates. I have all the data. And actually having the data feels nice. It's nice to have the data. But I realized that there was, you know, these events, these dukkha installations, we could call them, and they were always immediately followed, not immediately, but soon after followed, by something that happened in my life that I'm most grateful for. And as you can hear in the story, there was like these experiences and these long gaps, these latency gaps in another one. But then, like even this last one I talked about, it was really soon after, right? It was very, very soon after. So we start to realize that the reason your life is meaningful and the reason that you're embracing and embarking on whatever it is that you're embarking on is only been really inspired and encouraged by the things that you've been through that were challenging. Right? So I call it this emotion I call the grateful sorrow. So I'm so grateful for all the sorrow that I've been through, because I wouldn't be so grateful for all the sorrow that I've been through had I not gone through it. And it's that lessening and that more connected to life, to experience, to others. So I offer this for your reflection. Thank you for your kind attention. And let's just sit for a few minutes.